This episode is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 6 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Sounds great.
Yeah. So let's just jump right into the deep dive today. We're covering something that is, frankly, mission critical for anyone staring down the barrel of the Series 6 exam.
Oh, absolutely.
We're tearing apart the ultimate rules of the road for the Series 6. Specifically, we're focusing on supervisory approvals for accounts.
Right.
And just to set the stakes right at the top here, this chunk of material, what FANARAO categorizes as Function 2.4, it is worth a massive 16% of your entire exam.
Yeah, 16%. That is not something you can just guess your way through.
No, definitely not. But here is the thing about studying for this. If you just sit there with a highlighter trying to memorize a dry alphabetical list of rules and timelines, your brain is going to reject it.
Oh, it completely bounces right off.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the quickest path to failing the exam, honestly. When people study FANARAO rules, they often make the mistake of viewing them as this list of arbitrary, annoying speed limits, you know, just designed to slow down their business.
Right, like red tape.
Exactly. But it really helps to shift your perspective entirely. Think of the financial industry as a giant, incredibly complex, interconnected machine.
Okay, I like that. A machine.
Right. And every single rule, every signature requirement, every bizarre timeline you have to memorize, it all exists to make a very specific gear in that machine turn safely, you know, without catching on fire.
Without catching on fire. Yeah, that's the goal.
Right. So the goal of our deep dive today isn't just to recite the regulatory manual. Our goal is to understand how and why those gears interlock.
Mm.
Because once you understand the underlying mechanics of supervision, like the actual why behind the mountain of paperwork, you won't have to memorize anymore. You'll just be able to predict the answer to exam questions you have never even seen before.
Wow. Okay. Because you understand the underlying logic.
Exactly.
So it's about reverse engineering the machine, not just, you know, memorizing the owner's manual.
Precisely.
I think that's the only way my brain can process this. But before we get into the nitty gritty of the paperwork, like who exactly is holding the pen and signing what, we really need to talk about the system that creates the paperwork in the first place, right?
Yes.
Like where does the framework even come from?
That is exactly where we need to start. Mm. So for a Series 6 broker dealer, the entire supervisory framework is built on a foundation of three complementary rules.
Three rules.
Yeah, three. And you have to think of these three rules as a vertical stack, not an a la carte menu.
Right.
A firm does not get to pick and choose which ones to follow. They must comply with all three simultaneously just to keep their doors open.
Wow. Okay, all three. So what's the first one?
First in the stack is the overarching supervision rule. This is the requirement for the firm to actually build the system itself. They have to establish the playbook, which in industry terms is called the written supervisory procedures or the WSPs.
WSPs. Got it. Yeah.
Right. Then second, layered right on top of that, is the supervisory control rule.
Okay.
This is the mandate to continually test the system you just built to ensure your playbook actually works when it, you know, meets reality.
Right. When things actually happen.
Exactly. And then third, sitting alongside those FANARAO rules is the MSRB Municipal Supervision Rule.
The MSRB.
Yeah. That is the municipal market's parallel to FANARAO's rules. And it covers things that Series 6 reps deal with all the time, like 529 college savings plans, local government investment pools, and ABL accounts.
Okay, let's unpack this because I want to make sure I'm wrapping my head around the difference between those first two. Because supervision rule and supervisory control rule, they sound like two ways of saying the exact same thing.
They do, yeah.
And I just know the exam is going to try to trick me on the vocabulary there. So let's use an analogy.
Okay.
Think of the basic supervision rule as like the physical process of building a car on an assembly line.
I like it.
You're installing the engine, you're bolting in the seatbelts, attaching the steering wheel. That is the firm writing its written supervisory procedures, its WSPs. You're constructing a vehicle that is theoretically designed to be safe for the road.
Right, theoretically safe.
Right, but then you have the supervisory control rule, and that is the safety inspector taking the brand new car you just built, putting a crash test dummy in the driver's seat, and just driving it headfirst into a solid concrete wall at 60 miles an hour.
Yes.
Just to see if the airbags actually deploy.
That is a perfect framework for understanding the difference. Building the car is your standard supervision. Crashing the car to test if the safety mechanisms hold up under pressure, That is supervisory control. It is literally supervising the supervision.
Supervising the supervision. I love that.
Yeah, and it highlights a really critical historical truth in the financial industry, which is that a firm can have a beautifully written, incredibly thorough set of WSPs sitting in a massive three-ring binder on a shelf in the compliance department.
Right, gathering dust.
Exactly. If no one actually reads that binder, or if the procedures are completely impractical for the daily workflow, the supervision fails.
Makes sense.
And the SEC and FINRA saw this happening way too often. So they instituted the supervisory control rule to force firms to look in the mirror.
So they have to actually test it?
Yeah. This rule demands that a designated principal at the firm must rigorously test and verify the firm's supervisory procedures.
Mm-hmm.
They have to look at the data, identify any significant exceptions or compliance failures, and then, crucially, they have to submit a formal report to senior management.
Oh, to senior management. So the higher-ups had to see it.
Exactly. And this report details the test results and outlines the new amended procedures they've adopted to, you know, plug the leaks they found during testing.
Wait, let me push back on that timeline for a second.
Sure.
Because I'm thinking about the logistics of starting a brand new broker-dealer.
Okay.
If a firm just opens its doors on January 1st, they don't really have any historical data to test yet, right? Yeah. They don't have a track record of failures to report on. Do they get a grace period? Like a new firm gets 2 or 3 years to figure out their WSPs before they had to do this massive crash test report.
See, that is a very logical assumption, and it is exactly the trap the exam setters are hoping you fall into.
Oh, wow.
The answer is absolutely not.
No grace period.
There is no special grace period for newbies. Every single firm, regardless of whether they have been in business for 50 years or 50 days, must conduct this testing and generate this supervisory control report at least annually.
At least annually. Okay, that is a huge exam alert for everyone listening. I want to pause and make this a direct question to you, the listener.
Let's do it.
Okay, quick pop quiz for you listening. If you get a question on the test that says, a newly registered broker-dealer is preparing its initial supervisory control report, under FINRA rules, when must this first report be filed?
Think about it.
Just giving you a beat. Nope. Do not look for an exemption. Do not look for an extended deadline. No special clock for newbies. The answer is at least annually, full stop.
Full stop.
FINRA does not care that you are new. In fact, they're probably more worried about your supervision because you are new.
Precisely. Yeah. The exam frequently invents highly plausible sounding exemptions to see if you'll take the bait.
Right.
Now, we've established that the firm has a playbook and they test the playbook, but we need to ground this in physical reality. Where does all of this oversight actually happen?
Okay, the where.
Right. That brings us to a critical structural concept. It's the Office of Supervisory Jurisdiction.
The OSJ.
Universally referred to as the OSJ, exactly. The OSJ is the nerve center of a broker-dealer's compliance network.
Quite.
By definition, an office is designated as an OSJ if it engages in specific high-risk, high-oversight functions.
Like what?
That includes activities like order execution, maintaining custody of customer funds or securities, giving final approval for retail communications. And most importantly, for the day-to-day life of a Series 6 rep, providing the final acceptance and approval of new customer accounts.
So if I'm a rep working in a tiny two-person office in a strip mall, you know, just handing out mutual fund prospectuses and gathering paperwork, I'm probably not in an OSJ.
Usually not, no.
I'm just in the standard branch office, and I have to send all my heavy-duty paperwork up the chain to the OSJ for the actual green light.
That is exactly how the hub and spoke model works in real life. The OSJ is the hub, the regular branch offices are the spokes, and because the OSJ handles all the heavy regulatory lifting, the inspection requirements are vastly different.
Okay, this is where the exam tries to get you. Let's lock those inspection cycles in, because this is prime testable material.
Yes, very testable.
Think about the human psychology of distance, right?
Mm.
If your boss sits at the desk next to you, you dot your I's and cross your T's. If your boss is in an OSJ 500 miles away, you might start cutting corners.
Exactly.
So FINRA mandates that an OSJ, the hub with all the power, the place approving the accounts and holding the funds, must be inspected by the firm at least annually.
Annually, yeah.
But a regular non-supervising branch office, the little spoke in the strip mall, that office only requires an inspection at least every 3 years.
Right.
So, listener, ingrain this in your mind. OSJ is annual. Regular branch is 3 years. Know the difference.
Absolutely. And you have to understand the operational rules behind that annual OSJ inspection too.
Okay.
An OSJ is required to have a designated, appropriately registered on-site principal with a regular and routine physical presence.
So someone actually in the building.
Exactly. FINRA wants a senior person breathing the air in that office every day.
Not just on a Zoom call.
No, physically there. Furthermore, when that annual inspection rolls around, the person conducting the inspection generally cannot be someone who is assigned to that specific office.
Oh, interesting.
And they certainly cannot be someone who reports to the manager of that office. It is a fundamental conflict of interest.
Right, because you can't grade your own homework.
Exactly. FINRA does not want a branch manager grading their own homework or forcing their subordinate to give them a passing grade.
Yeah, hey, give me a pass or you're fired.
Right. The inspector has to be independent of that specific reporting line to ensure the crash test we talked about earlier is actually legitimate.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
It preserves the integrity of the audit. Okay, so we have the system built, we know it's being tested annually, and we know the heavy lifting happens at the OSJ. Now that we've set the stage with the big picture, let's zoom all the way in.
Let's do it.
Let's look at the actual paperwork sitting on the desk. Now that we know where the approvals happen, who exactly is holding the pen? The who signs what game. Exactly. The who signs what game, which is the absolute core of function 2.4. Mm. Different actions in a financial firm carry vastly different levels of risk, right?
They do.
And therefore, they demand different levels of authority to sign off on them.
Yeah.
So to make these rules stick in our brains, I want to introduce a couple of recurring characters for us to use.
Oh, boy.
First up, we have Reckless Ricky.
Reckless Ricky.
Reckless Ricky. Ricky is a well-meaning but incredibly chaotic Series 6 registered rep. He is always hyped up on espresso. He wants to close deals immediately. He wants to do everything himself. And he absolutely loathes waiting for compliance approvals.
We all know a Ricky.
We do.
Mm-hmm.
Supervising Ricky is our second character, Principal Penny.
Okay.
Penny holds a Series 26 license, making her a registered principal. She is meticulous. She has the FINRA manual memorized. And she does absolutely everything strictly by the book.
I am already deeply concerned for Principal Penny's blood pressure.
Same, same.
But this dynamic between the eager rep and the cautious supervisor is exactly what you need to understand, because the exam is obsessed with matching the correct actor to the correct regulatory rule. So let's look at two heavily tested scenarios side by side to highlight the nuances in the signature rules.
Okay, pay me.
First, let's look at the general new account acceptance record. When Reckless Ricky brings in a new client and opens a basic mutual fund account, the customer account information rule requires a signature on the paperwork.
Okay.
And that signature shows that the account was officially accepted in accordance with the firm's policies. So the exam asks, who signs the new account acceptance?
Right.
The exact text of the rule specifies it must be signed by a partner, an officer, or a manager.
Whoa, hold on. Let me stop you right there and highlight this for the listener.
Yeah.
Did you catch what the expert just said?
Yeah.
A partner, an officer, or a manager. Notice what is missing from that list.
Yeah.
It does not say registered principal.
It does not.
If you are sitting in the exam center and the question asks who signs the general new account acceptance record, I guarantee you a registered principal will be option A or option B. And if you click it, you have fallen right into the trap.
It is one of the most brilliant traps on the exam, really, because it preys on a very logical assumption.
Sounds so right.
Right. Most candidates assume that every single supervisory signature in a broker-dealer must belong to a licensed principal. But you have to look at the why behind this specific rule.
So why is it different?
The general acceptance of a standard new account is primarily an administrative confirmation. The person signing is verifying that the firm's administrative procedures were followed.
Okay.
Like that the customer identification program was completed, that the Patriot Act checks were run, that the required privacy disclosures were delivered to the client. This administrative checklist can be verified and signed off by a designated branch manager or officer who doesn't necessarily hold a principal's license.
Oh, wow. Okay. That fundamentally shifts how I think about it. It's an administrative checkpoint. Not necessarily an investment risk checkpoint. But let's contrast that with a situation that does carry massive risk. Let's say Ricky's client has had their account open for a few years. The client recently got married, and Ricky wants to update the account to add the new spouse as a joint owner.
Okay.
So we are doing an account name or designation change. Who approves that? Can the same administrative manager just sign off on it?
Absolutely not. This situation is entirely different, and this is where Principal Penny steps in.
Okay, Principal Penny to the rescue.
Yes. The customer account records rule explicitly states that no change in account name or designation may be made unless it is authorized by a qualified and registered principal.
So it has to be Penny.
It has to be Penny. And the rule includes a massive, highly testable caveat.
Which is?
The principal must be, quote, personally informed the essential facts relied upon to make the change.
Okay, personally informed. Let's visualize what personally informed means in the real world. Reckless Ricky cannot just print out a name change form, slap a sticky note on it that says, I got married, leave it in Penny's physical inbox at 4:59 p.m. on a Friday, and expect her to just rubber stamp it before she goes home.
Definitely not.
Why? Because changing a name on an account or adding a joint owner is one of the highest fraud risks in the entire financial industry.
It really is.
Think about it. If I can get my name added to your account, I now have the legal right to liquidate your assets and wire the money to my own bank.
Yes.
That is a nightmare scenario for a broker dealer.
A total nightmare.
So Ricky has to physically or virtually stand in front of Penny and explain the essential facts. Hey, Penny, my client John Smith got married. Here is his updated Know Your Customer profile. Here is a certified copy of the marriage certificate. And here's the signed authorization from John requesting the change.
Precisely. The severity of the risk dictates the strictness of the rule. Accepting a brand new account with zero assets in it is a baseline risk, but altering the legal ownership of assets that are already sitting in the firm's custody.
Huge risk.
That is an extreme risk of misappropriation. That demands the registered principal's direct informed involvement. They cannot claim ignorance later. By signing, Penny is stating she reviewed the underlying evidence.
She owns that decision.
She absolutely does.
Okay, I want to throw a slightly absurd but entirely possible hypothetical at Ricky to test another rule.
Oh, I can't wait.
Let's say Ricky has a high net worth client who is leaving for a 2-month silent meditation retreat high in the Himalayas.
Nice.
No phone, no internet, completely off the grid. The market is incredibly volatile right now. And Ricky wants to be able to trade mutual funds on this client's behalf while they're sitting in silence so they don't miss out on any major market moves.
Right.
So Ricky is looking to establish discretionary authority. Now, Ricky being Ricky, he wants to just handshake on this and get trading.
Of course he does.
What are the specific hurdles Ricky actually has to clear to make this happen without getting barred from the industry?
Well, discretionary authority is another area where FINRA gives zero leeway. For Ricky to legally execute a discretionary trade, he needs to clear two distinct non-negotiable hurdles.
Two hurdles.
First, he must obtain prior written authorization from the customer.
Okay.
The client heading to the Himalayas must physically sign a document granting Ricky the power to make trading decisions without consulting them first. Verbal authorization means absolutely nothing.
So no handshake.
No handshake. Second, Ricky needs written acceptance of the account by the member firm, specifically a designated partner, officer, or manager. And this firm acceptance must happen before Ricky executes the very first discretionary trade.
Before?
Yes. He cannot trade on Tuesday and get the approval paperwork signed on Wednesday.
Right, because if the trade goes bad on Tuesday, the firm is on the hook.
Exactly.
And once the paperwork is in place, does Ricky just have a blank check to trade forever with no oversight?
Not at all. Establishing the discretionary account is just step one.
Okay.
Step two is ongoing supervision. Once the account is approved for discretion, a principal must review and approve every single discretionary order promptly after execution.
Wow, every single one.
Every single one. The firm has to ensure Ricky isn't just churning the account to generate commissions while the client is chanting on a mountain.
Okay, so this brings up a rule of thumb I've heard veteran compliance officers use, and I want everyone listening to internalize this as a mantra for Reckless Ricky. Say it with me in your head. Root it up, never self-approve.
Root it up, never self-approve.
Root it up, never self-approve. As a Series 6 registered representative, Ricky never, under any circumstances, approves his own new accounts. He never approves his own account, designation changes. He never approves his own discretionary orders.
Never.
It does not matter how experienced he is. He gathers the information and he routes it up the chain to Principal Penny or the designated manager.
That concept alone will save you on multiple exam questions. Self-approval completely destroys the Four Eyes principle of compliance.
Four Eyes principle, I like that.
Yeah, it's the idea that at least two pairs of eyes must review every critical action. The representative initiates or obtains the request. The principal or manager provides the oversight and approval. The roles can never overlap in one person.
Perfect. Okay, so we've established that Principal Penny is the gatekeeper. with her Series of 26 license. She is fully qualified to supervise and approve all of Ricky's standard business, right? Mm-hmm. The mutual funds, the variable annuities.
All right.
But what happens when Ricky brings her a slightly different piece of paperwork?
Uh-oh.
Let's say Ricky lands a young couple as clients, and they want to start saving for their newborn's education. Ricky writes up the business, fills out the application for a 529 college savings plan, and walks it over to Penny's desk.
Right.
Wait, let me think this through. If Penny is a registered principal, and she supervises Ricky, she can just sign off on whatever he sells, right? If he sells a mutual fund, she signs. If he sells a 529 college plan, she signs. Is it really that simple?
It is not that simple. And this right here is perhaps the most dangerous regulatory trap in the entire unit.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yes. It catches thousands of candidates off guard. If Ricky hands a 529 plan application to Principal Penny, Penny needs to slide that paperwork right back across the desk and say, I am legally not allowed to approve this. You need to find a Series 51 or a Series 53 principal.
Wait, really? Her Series 26 license just stops working.
Exactly. Her Series 26 is completely powerless here.
Why?
And to understand why, we need to introduce the third rule in our structural stack,
right?
The MSRB Municipal Supervision Rule.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting.
It does. The Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board, or MSRB, is an entirely separate regulatory body from FINRA. They govern the municipal securities market. For a Series 6 representative like Ricky, the universe of products he is allowed to sell is quite small, but it does include a specific carve-out for what are called municipal fund securities.
Okay.
This category includes 529 college savings plans, local government investment pools, or LGIPs, and ABLE accounts for individuals with disabilities.
Ah, okay. So 529s, LGIPs, and ABLE accounts aren't just regular mutual funds wrapped in the tax bill. Legally, they are classified as municipal securities.
Precisely. They are established by states or local government entities. And because they are municipal products, the MSRB dictates that they must be supervised by a municipal principal.
But Penny is a principal.
Principal Penny holds a Series 26 license. The formal title of the Series 26 is the Investment Company and Variable Contracts Products Principal.
Okay.
It grants her the authority to supervise standard mutual funds and variable annuities. It grants her absolutely zero regulatory authority over municipal securities.
That's great.
If a broker-dealer allows Principal Penny to sign off on Ricky's 529 plan applications, the firm has just blatantly violated MSRB rules.
That is wild. It's like having a license to fly a commercial jet, but getting arrested for driving a school bus because you don't have the right endorsement.
That's a great way to put it, yeah.
Okay, listener. Ricky hands a 529 plan app to Penny. What does Penny say? I'll give you a beat.
Mm-hmm.
She says, get this away from me. I need a Series 51 or 53 principal.
Exactly.
So if Penny's Series 26 is useless for a 529, who does the firm actually need to hire to supervise this business?
The firm needs a principal who holds either a Series 51 or a Series 53 license.
Okay, tell me the difference.
Well, the Series 53 is the overall municipal securities principal. This is the heavyweight license. It gives the holder unlimited responsibility for supervising all of the dealer's municipal securities business, from standard municipal bonds all the way down to 529 plans.
Okay, so that's the big one.
Right. But there is also a carve-out license, the Series 51. This is the Municipal Fund Securities Limited Principal. It is a much narrower license, specifically designed for firms that don't trade traditional municipal bonds, but do want to sell and supervise municipal fund securities like 529s, LGIPs, and ABA accounts.
Let me ask a practical question about how this works in the real world.
Sure.
Because a lot of broker-dealers are dual registered. They sell standard corporate mutual funds under FINRA rules, and they sell 529 plans under MSRB rules. How on earth does a compliance department manage that without pulling their hair out? Do they just pick whichever rule book is stricter and follow that?
Oh, they do not get to pick. They must satisfy both regulatory regimes simultaneously.
Sounds like a headache.
In practice, this creates a massive operational challenge. The firm has to integrate both sets of rules into one cohesive set of written supervisory procedures. So on the trading floor, the workflow splits based on the product. Ricky sells a standard mutual fund. He routes the paperwork to a left to Principal Penny with her Series 26. Ricky sells a 529 plan. He routes the paperwork to the right to the Series 51 or 53 principal. It is a parallel complementary supervisory regime.
Direct question to the listener. If you are taking the Series 6 and a question about supervisory approvals explicitly mentions a 529 plan, an LGIP, or an ABLE account, what should be happening in your brain?
Listen closely to this.
alarm bell should be ringing. The word municipal should be flashing in neon lights. If you see those products and you select the Series 26 principles the correct answer, you are walking into the trap. Always look for the 51 or the 53.
Absolutely. Do not fall for the Series 26 on a 529 plan.
Okay, let's shift gears completely. The account is open, the right principal signed the correct forms, and Ricky is feeling great.
Go Ricky!
But now, the client reaches into their pocket and hands reckless Ricky a physical paper check. Stotch everything. The client just handed Ricky a paper check. This is red alert territory for Fenerom, because if Ricky messes up this next part, he doesn't just get a slap on the wrist for a paperwork error. The firm's entire financial foundation is at risk, and the SEC gets involved.
You are not overstating it. The moment a registered representative physically touches a customer's check, a cash equivalent, or a stock certificate, an incredibly strict, unforgiving regulatory clock starts ticking.
Right.
Because in the eyes of the regulator, the firm is now in possession of customer assets.
Let's talk about this clock, because it is universally known as the noon next business day rule. Let's break this down.
Both the SEC and Fenerom mandate that customer funds must be promptly transmitted by the broker-dealer.
Promptly transmitted.
Yes, and they do not leave promptly open to interpretation. They define it explicitly.
Yeah.
Customer funds must be transmitted no later than noon of the next business day following receipt.
So if a client hands Ricky a check at 2:00 p.m. on a Monday afternoon, Ricky and his firm have until exactly 12:00 p.m. noon on Tuesday to forward that check to the clearing firm, the escrow agent, or the product issuer.
Exactly. Noon on Tuesday.
Okay. Let's explore the why here, because if you just memorize noon next day, it seems incredibly arbitrary. Why noon? Why not 5 p.m.? What is the catastrophic consequence if Ricky leaves that check in his desk drawer until Wednesday morning?
It all comes down to a fundamental concept called net capital.
Net capital.
You can think of net capital as the liquid financial cushion a broker-dealer must keep in the bank to ensure they can meet their obligations to customers.
Okay.
The SEC is terrified of a scenario where a broker-dealer goes bankrupt while holding millions of dollars of their customers' cash.
Understandably so.
Right. Now, the vast majority of Series 6 broker-dealers operate as what are called introducing or non-carrying firms. This means they do not hold customer funds. They just introduce the business to a clearing firm or a mutual fund company. Because their risk is relatively low, their net capital requirement is quite small, often around $5,000 to $25,000.
Okay, that's not too bad.
But if Ricky holds that customer check past the noon deadline on Tuesday, the regulators no longer view his firm as an introducing broker. Legally, the firm transitions into a status where they are carrying or holding customer funds.
Because they physically have it.
Yes.
And what does that mean for the firm's bank account?
It means their minimum net capital requirement instantly skyrockets. A firm carrying customer funds might suddenly be required to hold $250,000 or more in liquid net capital.
Oh, wow. From $5,000 to $250,000.
Yes. And if the firm doesn't actually have that cash on hand, they are instantly in violation of the SEC net capital rule, which can lead to an immediate shutdown of the firm's operations. So Ricky's laziness with an envelope didn't just break a timeline rule. It inadvertently reclassified the firm's entire legal operating structure.
That is mind-blowing. The difference between a fully compliant broker-dealer and a firm facing regulatory shutdown is literally Ricky forgetting to check his outbox before he goes to lunch on Tuesday.
Yes, it really is that precarious.
Now, let's talk about how most Series 6 business actually functions. Because reps aren't usually taking checks written out to their own firm, right? They use a process called subscription way handling.
Yes, subscription way is the industry standard for mutual fund and variable annuity business.
Okay.
In a subscription way transaction, the customer does not make the check payable to Ricky's broker-dealer. Instead, the customer makes the check payable directly to the product issuer, so payable to the XYZ mutual fund company or the ABC life insurance company.
Okay, let's do a ridiculous scenario to prove a point. Ricky has a client who wants to invest $10,000 in a mutual fund. Ricky says, great, the paperwork is all set. Just make the check out to Ricky's vacation fund. I mean, just make it out to Ricky personally and I'll make sure it gets to the mutual fund company for you.
Look, I know you are framing that as a joke, but we have to state this with absolute clarity because it is a strict liability concept on the exam.
Oh, I'm sure people try it.
They do. A customer check must never, under any circumstances, be made payable to the representative personally. If Ricky accepts a check made out to his own name, he has committed a career-ending violation.
Career-ending.
Yes. It does not matter if his intentions are pure or if he plans to deposit it and immediately wire the funds to the issuer. It is considered commingling and misappropriation. subscription away checks must always go directly to the issuer.
Okay, here comes another exam trap. Let's say the client does it correctly. They write the check to the XYZ mutual fund company. It is purely subscription away. Does that mean Ricky and his firm are off the hook for all the paperwork? Can Ricky just toss the check in a FedEx envelope and mail it off without telling anyone?
Absolutely not. While writing the check to the issuer prevents the firm from legally carrying the funds, the firm still bears immense supervisory responsibility for that asset while it is in transit.
Right, because they took physical possession of it.
Exactly. The representative is required to safeguard the physical check and promptly forward it to the OSJ along with the completed application package. And here is the critical part.
Okay.
The firm must maintain a formal copy of the check, and they must log it in a checks received and forwarded blotter.
A blotter?
Yes, a blotter. This log must record the exact date the check was received from the customer and the exact date it was transmitted to the issuer.
So there is a permanent, verifiable audit trail.
Exactly. When FINRA audits the OSJ, one of the first things they ask for is the check blotter. They will cross-reference the dates to ensure the noon next business day rule is being honored.
So if the log shows a check came in on Monday, but the outgoing tracking number shows it left on Thursday,
the firm has a massive supervisory failure on its hands. A designated principal is required to review this log regularly, specifically to catch these delays.
Right. We found it in Ricky's desk drawer a week later. Is not going to fly.
Not at all.
Okay, so we've covered how to open accounts and how to take in money legally. But what about the situations where a firm has to slam on the brakes? What happens when they have to look a client in the eye and say no, or completely freeze an account?
This is a really important area of regulation right now.
So let's introduce our third character to explore this, Senior Sal. Sal is 70 years old. He has been a loyal client of Ricky's for 20 years, and he has a substantial nest egg.
Good for Sal.
Yeah, but one day, Sal walks into the branch office. He is highly agitated, visibly sweating, and he tells Ricky that his long-lost nephew just contacted him on social media.
Oh.
This nephew is in terrible trouble and desperately needs Sal to wire his entire life savings to a decentralized crypto wallet immediately.
This is a heartbreaking scenario, but unfortunately, it is incredibly common in the retail brokerage space. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, broker-dealers were caught in a legal catch-22.
How so?
Well, if they suspected the nephew was a scammer and blocked the wire transfer, the client could sue them for breach of contract and failure to execute instructions.
All right, it's my money, let me send it.
Exactly. But if they processed the wire and the money was stolen, the client's family would sue the firm for negligence.
A total catch-22.
So to solve this, FINRA created a specific mechanism called the Senior Investor Protection Rule. It provides a legal safe harbor for firms, allowing them to place a temporary hold on disbursements of funds or securities if they suspect financial exploitation.
But to use that safe harbor, the client has to qualify, right? Let's establish if Sal is covered by this rule. Sal is 70 years old.
Yes. The rule protects what FINRA defines as a specified adult.
A specified adult.
Right. And there are two ways to qualify as a specified adult. First, any natural person age 65 or older automatically qualifies. So Sal, at 70, is covered.
Okay, let's pause and emphasize the second half of that definition. What if the client isn't a senior citizen?
Mm.
What is the other way to qualify?
The second category is any natural person age 18 or older who the member firm reasonably believes has a mental or physical impairment that renders them unable to protect their own interests.
Okay.
This could be a younger client with severe cognitive decline or a developmental disability.
So, because Sal is 70, he is a specified adult. Ricky and Principal Penny firmly believe that Crypto Nephew is a scammer. They decide to place a temporary hold on the wire transfer. This is where the exam is going to test you on the strict timeline mechanics the firm must follow to keep their safe harbor protection intact. Let's break this timeline down step by step.
Let's do it.
Step one is communication. A notice of the hold must be given within 2 business days. The firm has to notify all authorized parties on the account and specifically the trusted contact person that Sal listed when he opened the account, letting them know a hold has been placed and why.
Correct. The notice requirement is immediate.
Within 2 business days.
Yes. So once the hold is placed, how long does it last initially? The rule states the initial hold expires no later than 15 business days after it was first placed.
15 business days. Why 15 days? Why not just freeze it forever?
Because it's the client's money, not the firm's. The 15 days is designed to give the firm's compliance or anti-fraud department enough time to conduct a thorough internal review of the facts and circumstances.
Right.
They need time to verify if the nephew actually exists or if it's a known scam ring.
But what if 15 days isn't enough time? What if the investigation is complex, the nephew is using burner phones, and the firm just can't get to the bottom of it in 2 weeks?
If the firm's internal review supports a reasonable belief that financial exploitation is occurring or has occurred, the rule allows the firm to extend the hold by an additional 10 business days.
Okay, so let's do the math for the exam. We have the initial 15 days plus the 10-day extension based on the internal review. That brings us to 25 business days total. Is that the absolute limit?
No, there is one more extension available.
Okay.
If the firm needs even more time and they have formally reported the suspected exploitation to a state regulator, an adult protective services agency, or a court of competent jurisdiction, they can extend the hold by a further 30 business days.
Okay, listen, now write this sequence down. 15 initial, plus 10 for internal review, plus 30 if you involve the authorities. If you add it all up, a firm can hold a disbursement for a theoretical maximum of 55 business days under this specific rule. Memorize those numbers, 15, 10, 30. Max 55.
55 days, exactly.
Now, I want to use logic to drive our next transition. Sal's situation is obvious elder abuse. The firm is trying to protect Sal from an outside attacker.
Right.
But what if the firm spots something moving through Ricky's accounts that isn't a scammer attacking a client, but rather a client intentionally doing something highly illegal?
Oh, this happens.
Like, what if the 30-year-old client is structuring cash deposits right under the $10,000 reporting threshold to hide money from the IRS? How does the firm slam the brakes then?
That completely changes the regulatory playbook. We are no longer dealing with elder protection. We are dealing with federal anti-money laundering, or AML, laws.
AML, got it.
When a firm suspects a client is engaging in money laundering or financing terrorism, they are required to investigate, and if appropriate, file a suspicious activity report, universally known as a SAR, with the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network.
So what does this all mean? The firm freezes the account while they investigate and file the SAR. The 30-year-old client tries to log in, sees the restriction, and immediately calls reckless Ricky, screaming into the phone, demanding to know why his account is locked.
Uh-huh.
Direct question to the listener. If Ricky restricts an account because of a SAR, what exactly does he tell the client? I'll give you a beat.
Think about it.
If your answer was, Ricky tells him they suspect him of money laundering, Ricky is going to federal prison.
He really is. This is the concept of tipping off, and it is one of the most strictly enforced rules in the financial industry.
Tipping off?
Yes. If a firm restricts an account because they are investigating a SAR, there is an absolute federal prohibition against disclosing the existence of that SAR or the underlying investigation to the subject of the report.
So what is the actual script Ricky uses on the phone? It has to be incredibly awkward.
It is incredibly awkward, but it is necessary. Ricky must simply state that the account is currently under review or restricted per firm policy, and that he cannot provide further details at this time.
So he just stonewalls them.
Basically, yes. The visible restriction on the account is obvious to the client, but the regulatory reason behind the restriction must remain completely classified. Disclosing the SAR tips off the criminal, allowing them to destroy evidence or flee, which compromises a federal investigation. Tipping off is a criminal offense, not just a FINR violation.
Wow. Okay, so Ricky holds the line, doesn't tip off the client, and eventually the relationship deteriorates. Or maybe the client just decides to move to a different firm. The client calls up and says, close my account immediately.
Okay.
Since Ricky is the rep on the account, can he just pull up his CRM system, hit a close account button, and be done with it?
No, he cannot. Just like opening an account requires supervision, closing an account is a highly regulated event. Even if the customer explicitly requests the closure, Ricky cannot act unilaterally.
Everything has to be supervised.
Everything. Every account closure requires a verifiable paper trail. The firm needs documented transfer instructions if the assets are moving to another broker-dealer. They need to confirm the cancellation of any open, unexecuted orders. They need to ensure there are no lingering debit balances.
Right.
And bringing us full circle to the very beginning of our discussion, the actual closure of the account requires written principal approval. Ricky gathers the request, but he routes it up to Principal Penny for the final sign-off.
Root it up, never self-approve. It applies on the first day of the account, and it applies on the last day of the account.
Exactly.
All right, my friend. We have covered a massive amount of conceptual and tactical ground today. It is time to lock this knowledge into your short-term memory before you walk into that exam room.
Let's do it.
We are going to do a rapid-fire recap of the top testable takeaways from Function 2.4. I'm going to ask the question, and I want the listener to try and answer it in their head before the expert responds. Ready?
I'm ready. Let's run it.
Number one, who signs the general new account acceptance record to confirm administrative procedures were followed?
A partner, an officer, or a manager. It does not necessarily have to be a registered principal.
Number two, who approves a name or designation change on an existing account, like adding spouse?
A qualified registered principal, and they must be personally informed of the essential facts before signing. There is no rubber stamping allowed for name changes.
Number three, who is qualified to supervise the sale of a 529 college savings plan?
A principal holding a Series 51 or a Series 53 license. A standard Series 26 principal has no authority over municipal fund securities.
Number four, to avoid inadvertently carrying customer funds and violating net capital rules, when must a physical customer check be transmitted?
It must be promptly transmitted, which FennishAw explicitly defines as no later than noon of the next business day following receipt.
Number five, under the Senior Investor Protection Rule for temporary holds, what is the definition of a specified adult?
Any natural person age 65 or older, or any person 18 and older with a mental or physical impairment that renders them unable to protect their own interests.
Boom. That is your Function 2.4 cheat sheet right there.
It really is. And as we wrap up, I want to offer one final way to think about everything we've discussed today.
Okay.
If we connect all of this, the OSJ inspections, the 55-day hold limits, the check blotters, the signatures on the name changes to the bigger picture, it reveals a profound truth about our industry.
What's that?
In the financial world, trust isn't a feeling. Trust isn't an emotion or a handshake. Trust is a mathematically and procedurally verifiable paper trail.
I love that.
When you pass this exam and become a Series 6 registered representative, you aren't just a salesperson moving mutual funds. You are the frontline defender of that verifiable trust. Think about how your daily habits, every form you take the time to route up to a principal, every check you meticulously log before noon will either build that unbroken trail of trust or break it entirely.
That is exactly the mindset you need to adopt. Go into that testing center, visualize reckless Ricky trying to cut corners, visualize Principal Penny catching those mistakes, remember the noon next business day, clock ticking in the background, and absolutely crush this exam. We will catch you on the next deep dive.